This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. John Powers about his book titled Technology and the Making of Experimental Film Culture, published by Oxford University Press, which is really interesting because it takes a whole bunch of types of technology, some of which I admit were relatively new to me, though absolutely fascinating, and looks at how the avant-garde, how filmmakers, how this culture, how these norms thought about these technologies, embraced them in some instances, and invested them with all sorts of meanings and values. So it's a really interesting kind of history exploration. There's a lot to get into here. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. Would you mind starting us off with a bit of a foundation, introducing yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
My name is John Powers. As you say, I'm an assistant professor of film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis in the U.S. I'm a film historian who specializes in experimental or avant-garde film and video. And this book really started with my interest in reading a lot about the experimental films that I love. And in the course of doing that, I ended up reading a lot of interviews with filmmakers. And I noticed that they all talked about things like Bolex cameras, reversal film stocks, film labs, optical printers. But it was often taken for granted that scholars knew what those were or how they worked, or even if not that, just that other inputs were more important. So I was sort of guided by the idea that those of us who were film historians, film theorists, those of us who, like me, didn't have a film 16-millimeter based film production background should have a better understanding of these technologies and how all of these really interesting artists were using them. Then, as I gained some knowledge about that, gained some understanding about that, it brought me back to the films. And I found that when I was able to look at them with fresh eyes and watch them again with this knowledge, I had a richer appreciation of them, not one that was diminished. And so I wanted to communicate to people who care about this kind of work, and hopefully even some who don't or don't know that they care about it, what can be revealed about films when you look at or focus on this nexus of artistic process and technology and the artistic and the kind of social relationships that it all makes possible.
Very interesting. Thank you for giving us that kind of backstory. And I now, I suppose, feel a bit better that I didn't know all these technologies coming into the book myself, also not having that kind of film production background. So I suppose staying on that idea of kind of what you're revealing in the book, what kinds of conceptions or myths about avant-garde filmmakers are you maybe busting or complicating or adding nuance to?
Experimental filmmaking, I think one of the things I'm arguing in this book is that experimental filmmaking has conventions, it has patterns, it has established techniques. And also that's something that we should celebrate rather than fear. So it's commonly the term avant-garde is commonly kind of referenced as in its origins is coming from the military, that is the avant-garde, was the advanced guard that goes out and scouts ahead of the regular army and then reports back. Well, that creates a problem, and that is that what is an avant-garde cinema, or really any other kind of avant-garde artistic medium in some ways, that must, as its mandate, continually reinvent the wheel, that you're perpetually committed to the new, to the revolutionary, that you, when you're conceiving of what you're doing as an artist in those terms, then to repeat oneself or to replicate techniques or concepts that are already established is an inherently conservative move. And yet, those of us who love this work and see a lot of it, many of us have had the experience of going to film festivals where they show experimental films or something like this, and you see many of these same techniques or tropes or ideas or conventions repeated. I mean, it's very obvious that there are patterns, that there are types of work that are produced. So I wanted to just be open about asking where these come from and why they're so durable. And so one answer then that, you know, became the focus of this book is that it's about how experimental filmmakers use this 16 millimeter based technology, and that from the techniques that they've innovated and from the discourse that I'm sure we'll talk about as we get into the book later, from those things come some of these ideas or conventions or techniques, and maybe that's something that's really interesting about the avant-garde, that they were able to, or experimental filmmakers were able to, create such a rich body of techniques and language from this technology and other sources too. But we should celebrate that rather than fear it. I think, you know, another myth or conception that I wanted to complicate with this book was the idea that experimental filmmakers lack technical or technological sophistication. It's interesting to me that this position has been embraced by both experimental cinema's detractors and supporters. So if you're an experimental film detractor, it's common to hear the kind of response to the films that the filmmakers don't really know what they're doing. They're waving the camera about this way or that. There's a kind of lack of discrimination, or maybe there's a haphazardness or a formlessness, that they lack the technological sophistication that professional filmmakers have. On the other hand, if you're an avant-garde supporter, of course, which I am, that this can often be a point of pride, because it's a signifier of the authenticity and vitality of experimental cinema. You often have filmmakers citing their amateur roots in the sense of the root of amateur as lover, that these are poetic innovations, and that being kind of lo-fi has a sort of aesthetic and political valorization of freedom and immediacy to it. And I wanted to argue that actually a great many experimental filmmakers are as or more technically knowledgeable than their commercial counterparts, and that their innovations with technology are incredibly creative and resourceful and things to celebrate. Many of the filmmakers that I write about in the book know this medium, 16 millimeter filmmaking, intimately. And some of the more extreme rhetoric, let's say, on both sides can sort of obscure this fact. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, the kind of amateur affiliation or emancipatory political rhetoric was very crucial for the avant-garde, especially at the historical moment that I'm writing about, and we shouldn't underestimate that. But I wanted to suggest with this book that it was as much a political and discursive kind of cultural performance that the avant-garde of amateurism that the avant-garde was touting, as it was something that was based in reality.
Okay, this is, I think, very helpful to understand as a kind of overarching argument of what you're doing, so that we can now talk a bit about kind of how you're doing that and the specific areas you investigate. So you have this great sentence kind of declaring some of the ways in which you're approaching complicating these stories, right? Quote, "This book treats the material and discursive manifestations of experimental film culture as intercausal." Can you tell us about this way of approaching the analysis?
Yes. I wanted to understand how technology, artistic practice, and discourse intersect. So I wanted to understand how filmmakers talking about technology and kind of loading it up with meaning were as important for cultivating a cinematic avant-garde as the materialities of the technology. In the humanities, we're, of course, well-versed in the intentional fallacy that an artwork's meaning can be contained to the artist's intention in making it. But I wanted to emphasize that in the way that filmmakers talk about technology in their artist statements, in interviews, in their critical writing, in their public exchanges, we can locate the basis of the social relationships that formulate the problems and the questions and the practices of the avant-garde's use of technology, not in a simple artist's intention kind of way, but that actually we should pay attention to how the language that they use and the way they talk about their artistic practice does matter in terms of setting the table for a conversation. Also, I wanted to avoid technological determinism. That I wanted to be careful not to write a book where technology was just hardware, and it sort of set the kind of the material or physical characteristics of it kind of determined or limited the operations of what artists could do with it. In other words, just because the Bolex camera has single frame operation or because Kodachrome film stock can give you very saturated colors doesn't really guarantee that a cinematic avant-garde is going to take the form that it does. It sets the conditions, but it doesn't determine the outcome. So intercausality kind of became a mantra or a kind of guiding light as I was writing the book, because it was a challenge that in the analyses of the particular films that I was talking about, I would keep the textual properties of the films, the materiality of the technology, and then the discourses around them in balance. That was the challenge that I set for myself.
Okay, very helpful to have that perspective and kind of understand your approach here. And then start to think about kind of how you apply it. The book focuses on a few key technologies to really allow for an in-depth exploration of kind of what they are and how they're being used and therefore how people are thinking about them. Can you tell us which technologies you focus on and how you chose these to examine?
There are four technologies that I talk about in the book. As I say, there could have been others. There could have been more. Let me just tell you what they are first. I talk about the Bolex H16 camera, which was the most popular 16mm camera in use among experimental filmmakers. I talk about reversal film stocks. These were 16mm film stocks that were in widespread use in the 1960s and 70s. I focus on two in particular, Tri-X and Kodachrome, which were made by Eastman Kodak. Film labs, where filmmakers would have their films processed and printed, and then in some cases they could make effects like superimpositions or dissolves in the printer, or have them made for them. And then optical printers, which are refotography devices that allow filmmakers to alter or change footage that has been previously exposed, whether it's their own footage or whether it's found footage. I imagine we'll be able to talk more about the specifics of these technologies in a bit, but I chose them because, first of all, they're very central to mid-century experimental filmmaking. These were technologies that filmmakers used extensively. They also talked about them quite a bit, so there was a lot of material that I could unearth and dig up about them. In many ways, these are the technologies that I think provided the foundation for experimental filmmaking. I don't talk about sound technologies or projectors or Super 8 or video, all of which I could have, but I found that either they were covered adequately by other scholars, or I found that they wouldn't have allowed me to tell as coherent a story, because part of the story is that the Bolex camera and film stocks establish the avant-garde's investment in consumer technologies that were marketed to everyday users like you or me. It wasn't just experimental filmmakers who used them, but anyone who was shooting 16 millimeter film. Film labs were more specialized. Those were technological processes that were carried out by technicians and utilized by film professionals. And then the optical printer, optical printers as they used them in Hollywood weren't really available to experimental filmmakers by and large, but the kind of DIY variant that came out of experimental film culture was something that was internal to the culture. It was tinkerers and people making things for this purpose. And so I found that there was a different kind of flavor to the interactions between the filmmakers and these technologies.
Okay, this is very interesting to understand, especially kind of the decision-making behind it. And we are absolutely going to go into more detail about them. So starting with the Bolex, you talk about how avant-garde filmmakers, quote, reasserted the physicality of the body in using this technology, for example, making things like time-lapse sequences. Can you kind of talk about what they're doing here in making this and how this impacted, kind of going back to what you said earlier, how they were talking about the Bolex and their relationship with it as a technology?
Yes, the Bolex was a Swiss camera that is made in Switzerland. And if you go through a lot of the marketing material from Paylard, who the company that made the Bolex, they really trumpet the camera as a precision instrument, that it was as reliable as a Swiss watch. This comparison was very frequent. And what they mean by that is that it's highly efficient. They use the word precision over and over again. And experimental filmmakers did pick up on the fact that the camera had this reputation. The filmmaker George Kuchar calls it a Bolex, a Swiss thing of clicking excellence. And he says it has mathematical perfection. And so the Swiss watch analogy could be extended as something that could very perfectly inscribe time in a very mechanical way. And the Bolex came with a single frame function, not all amateur cameras had this, where you could take one frame at a time. And that in some ways seemed to instantiate this. So it was logical that the Bolex was a good camera for making time-lapse sequences, which we're all familiar with, the clouds, you know, passing over the course of a day in a matter of a few seconds, because you could use the single frame release over a period of hours. And in so doing, the camera could unearth the hidden processes of the invisible world, whether that be nature, whether it be city life. And so when you read a lot of stuff in amateur periodicals and Bolex marketing from this period, the things that they talk about a lot when it comes to time lapse are, first of all, that the camera operator remove themselves from the shooting physically. You're not supposed to touch the camera. You're not supposed to interrupt the kind of scientific or maybe quasi-scientific process of taking the time lapse, because then you would show evidence of the maker and it would call attention to itself. The other thing is that you wanted to click frames off at regular intervals, because if you don't space out in advance when you're going to take a frame at precisely what time, then you're going to get a sequence that's too short or where the changes happen too slowly or too quickly. So as I was looking at experimental time-lapse films, it became clear to me that experimental filmmakers realized in a kind of maybe even intuitive way that if they inserted their own physicality back into this process, if rather than disavow their own physicality, if they insisted on their physical intervention, and then if they kind of threw that whole idea about regular intervals out the window, if they said, well, what about irregular intervals. I take one when I kind of feel it. Well, when you look at a sequence that way that results from that, time-lapse becomes an instantiation of kinetic energy where there's motion as a virtue almost in and of itself. Images can explode onto the screen in these short ecstatic bursts. The scholar Scott McDonald called them retinal collages, which I like quite a bit. So I was looking at films like Go, Go, Go by Marie Menken. This is a kind of very jittery time-lapse portrait of New York City, where Menken traverses the city sometimes by foot or in a car or in a train, and you get these single-frame sequences where pedestrians and traffic around office buildings and construction sites and a graduation ceremony kind of burst onto the screen. And she's hand-holding the camera, and she's clicking flip frames irregularly. So you really get the sensation of a body kind of hurtling through space and this unpredictable jumble of motion that the city's registering. And when Menken talked about this, she didn't talk about her work a lot. Unfortunately, she was underappreciated in the time that she made them, and so she wasn't able to do too many interviews. But she talked about feeling this kind of motivic joy, that is the joy of just something in motion. And so here's time lapse that's very different from a kind of detached, scientistic maybe presentation of it. I also talk about a film called Handheld Day by Gary Baedler, where it's a little bit akin to performance art. The film is him standing, it's a day's time lapse. The time lapse itself is very consistent, almost traditional. The kind of crux of the film, though, is that he's holding a mirror, a palm-sized mirror in his hand that reflects the mountain range in front of him. And so you get this kind of windows within windows presentation. But because he's standing there all day long, his body becomes fallible. I mean, not that it ever, I don't mean it becomes fallible. I guess I should say he fails to control the time lapse in the way that it's expected, because he has difficulty simply holding the mirror steady. And then that becomes folded into the form of the film, where his body asserts its own intentionality. And it becomes a little bit like performance art, where it's sort of at war with the technology in some way. So I found this when I looked at the Bolex camera, but then also all of these technologies, the thing about the body kept coming back, that the body was a way for experimental filmmakers to explore issues of control, issues of contingency, what happens when these technologies come into contact with physicality of the operator. And then that, of course, aligned with values in other art forms at that time, especially in painting and performance art, in dance. All of these mediums had their own versions of this, I would say.
Well, and also other technologies that you explore in the book. So if we turn to, for example, looking at film labs, there's still questions around control and contingency there as well. Can you talk a bit about how filmmakers conceptualize the labs and how they think about the impact on their work?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That too is often about control and contingency. One thing that experimental filmmakers are famous for, if they're famous for anything, is that they control, so to speak, every part of the process of making their films. These are usually films that are made by individuals completely and totally. But then you get to this fact, not often discussed in the literature, which is that at the very end of a film's life, control has to be ceded, at least to some extent, to a technician. The experimental filmmaker Hollis Frampton called the lab technicians the invisible proletariat of film workers, because it was sort of taken for granted. You didn't really see their work. It was sort of taken for granted that that films just were shot and then came out. But there was this step in between that this labor class was sort of doing. And then, of course, experimental films were often unorthodox. Even if they used standard procedures in terms of the making of the film, the way that the images were, quote unquote, supposed to look could be very elusive and even baffling to some lab technicians, not all, but some. So you see, as I talk about in the book, these two discursive tropes coming out of avant-garde filmmakers talking about their interactions with labs. One is that labs are adversarial. Lab owners and technicians are just punching a clock. They're cutting corners at every opportunity that they can. They're on the wrong side of the art-commerce divide. So there's a lot of grousing about ceding your control to the lab. The other kind of variant of this is labs as mystical, that they were mysterious, that they took your film behind closed doors and there were these arcane procedures that were performed in secrecy. It was sort of half science, half sorcery. It was the room that the filmmaker was not allowed to go in or even understand what was happening. But then I was looking at how experimental filmmakers mobilized this as part of their creative practice. So in some cases, I talk about them assigning meaning to particular lab procedures. I write about a fairly technical procedure in the book called AB rolling, which, to make a long story short, if I can, was a method for producing fades and dissolves in 16 millimeter, not 35 millimeter, but it involved printing rolls of film in stages. And you had to sync multiple rolls of film up on different rolls. And a lot of filmmakers found this to be very non-creative work. It's kind of drudge work to use a synchronizer and to get these rolls synced up. But experimental filmmakers realized that you could multiply printing rolls, not just A and B rolls, but maybe C and D rolls or even an E roll. And if you had that many images working potentially at one time, you could have a kind of complex choreography of fades and dissolves and superimpositions that was a little bit like composing images in time, almost like a musical metaphor, composing a sort of symphony in images. And I write about how filmmakers like Bruce Bailey and Stan Brakhage and Gunvor Nelson thought that this was a very productive metaphor for consciousness or memory. That when you see some of the films that they did this in, like Bailey's Quick Billy or Moon's Pool by Gunvor Nelson or Scenes from Under Childhood by Stan Brakhage, you have this complex image weave that in their discourse they likened to the kind of oceanic flow of consciousness or memory. And then, you know, I'll give you one other example. That's a particular lab procedure, but I also write about the problem of relinquishing control to the lab as itself a kind of engine for experimental film practice. So an example here is a film by J.J. Murphy called Print Generation, which is a kind of controlled experiment where Murphy took a minute's worth of film to his lab and he asked them to print a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, et cetera, of the same footage. And so that will degrade the image and the image will become illegible, more illegible with each generation that is printed. And by doing this, now the film itself has a very kind of clever structure where at first you see the images proceed from the kind of least legible to the most. And then in the second half, they go from the most back to the least again. So there's a kind of cognitive, you know, gamesmanship type component to it. But I was, and people have written about that pretty extensively, but I was interested in the fact that Murphy actually made the lab technicians kind of inadvertent collaborators. And their job was really to do exactly the thing that they were trained not to do. That is to let the images degrade. So I was interested in how Murphy kind of embraced that relinquishment of control as inherent to the process itself and made that in some ways the subject of his films.
I found this perhaps the technology I was the most fascinated by, this kind of back and forth of like, it's mysterious and magical, but kind of in an evil way. Oh, wait, but look what we can do with it. What sort of things are around? And so I found that absolutely fascinating. And it isn't something necessarily I had ever come across. I was so pleased to kind of discover it through this book.
You know, but, I'm glad that...
Oh, please. Oh,
I'm glad that you say that because... another thing I was trying to do in the book was very often technology, especially when it comes to artists working with it, is conceived of as a kind of limitation. That is, there are certain things that the technology prevents you from doing that your imagination would like to do. And so you have to figure out how to work around those limitations. And it's a kind of problem model. Like there's a problem and then the artist finds a solution. But I wanted to think of it more as I think you were talking about there as a kind of playground is the metaphor that I like to use. Like instead of thinking of these as impositions or limitations, what if we just thought of technology as providing this kind of openness of possibility that filmmakers could kind of play around with and experiment with and see what could happen.
Hmm. And it's really interesting to kind of read in the book how they sort of go from one to the other of thinking of the labs as being a problem to going, hang on a second, there might be stuff we can play with here. But I don't want to obsess about the labs too much. I probably could, but there are other things in the book. So we shall move on to the next one. And in fact, something that you brought up right at the beginning of our conversation that was one of the things you noticed that brought you into this project, film stocks. Why did avant-garde filmmakers talk about film stock so much? What was going on with these conversations? And what does this tell us about the community and the values being created in it?
Film stocks are an interesting one because at first I think film stock sounds really boring. Like, what could you possibly say about the raw material that you put into the camera? Isn't it just the thing that records the image? Or if you're going to talk about things like processing, you're getting into chemistry, and isn't that going to be too specialized or technical? And yet, perhaps paradoxically, this was where I found some of the most interesting aesthetic programs and conceptual approaches. So I focus on two stocks, Tri-X, which was a black and white stock that Eastman Kodak introduced in the 1950s and 60s, and then Kodachrome, which was their more famous, well, I don't know if it's more famous, but it was sort of famous amateur color stock. And in fact, it's 8mm Kodachrome is a Pruder film of the Kennedy assassination. And Paul Simon, of course, sings about the vibrant colors of Kodachrome. So that one has a little bit of, I think, cultural visibility. I could have chosen other ones like Ektachrome, which were very common among experimental filmmakers and actually a lot of professional filmmakers. But I found that these two stocks offered the best kind of story. They talked about them the most. I'll give you kind of the Kodachrome example, because to me it illustrates something else I was trying to do in the book. So Kodachrome, like I said, is part of the cultural lexicon. It gives you these golden colors. It's a very complicated stock, very, very slow. You need a lot of light to expose it. Very refined film stock. It required 28 steps to process. But it gave you very, very deeply saturated color. It favored the warm colors of the spectrum. As Paul Simon sings, you know, all the world's a sunny day, very beautiful yellow and oranges. And so a lot of amateur film discourse around Kodachrome then, not just among experimental filmmakers, but just amateur filmmakers more generally, was about how they could learn to balance the colors in their images. Because amateurs actually could shoot color with Kodachrome before, I mean, it was introduced in 1935, so they could actually shoot it before it was common for Technicolor productions, you know, that we did in Hollywood. You know, you could shoot color as an amateur probably more readily than a lot of professional filmmakers could. And so they would often look to two models, to nature and to painting, especially classical painting. Rembrandt comes up a lot. And so as I was looking into how the avant-garde was using this stock, I found that there were a couple of prominent ways of conceptualizing it. And both of them drew on those associations with nature and painting. And yet in some ways you could think of them as opposites or coming to different conclusions. One, which I associate with filmmakers like Nathaniel Dorsky, is about kind of luminist metaphysics. He has a film called Hours for Jerome, which is a very beautiful home movie that's in the vein of a medieval Book of Hours, where there are all these associations between the saturated colors of Kodachrome and then the juxtapositions of those colors, and then sacred art, stained glass, a love of light and color and glass. And Dorsky has a lot of really fabulous language to describe Kodachrome and this precious transmutable substance that he finds it to be, very much borrowed from a kind of medieval alchemical tradition. On the other hand, you then had filmmakers like Jack Smith or the Kuchar brothers. The Kuchar brothers were these, well, Mike Kuchar is still alive and George Kuchar passed away, but they were brothers who were obsessed with the kind of Orientalist technicolor fantasies that they saw at the movie theater as a kid. They loved Douglas Sirk films and Maria Montez movies and these kind of excessive escapist fantasies. And the color in those films, the technicolor, signified for them a kind of overindulgence or a sort of pleasurable artificiality. It's a kind of ersatz material or a kind of imitation technicolor, and that it's garish, especially if they printed their Kodachrome original to a Kodachrome print stock, which gets a little bit into the weeds in terms of the technical, but it wasn't something that most labs recommended doing because it would boost the colors past the point of prettiness and into the point of something that was garish or overindulgent. And these brothers would actually, and they would watch their own films, and they too have fabulous language to talk about it, but instead of it being about spiritualism or about metaphysics or about stained glass, they talk about it as horrible, as ugly, as degraded. God, they're so embarrassed by their, they're so embarrassed and yet they're so in love with their totally ersatz artificial world of decayed and degraded glamour. So the reason that the film stock chapter was especially fun for me to write or interesting for me to look into is because it illustrated the idea that the values within experimental filmmaking about what these technologies represented were contested. You know, there wasn't something as simple as an avant-garde way to do the technology and then a mainstream way to do it. You know, the commercial filmmakers do it this way, so we're experimental, so we do it that way. Instead, there were these values and there were these ideas and they were being batted around and they were being challenged within the community of filmmakers and critics who were interested in experimental filmmaking. And they were being reinflected by the filmmakers talking to each other, both literally, but then also in print, and then also through the films themselves, that there wasn't one way to look at any given technology. In some ways, there were even kind of opposing ways, and that it could be productive to kind of have a sort of informal exchange about those things.
Well, I admit I did start off that section going, what is there to say about film stocks? But as you've just demonstrated, there are in fact things to talk about. So thank you for giving us that overview of that section of the book. I'd like to now talk about optical printers. This is definitely in the category of technologies I was not particularly aware of before reading the book. I think what was most interesting to me was less the kind of like, what is this? Like physically, what are these things? More how they were being thought about by the filmmakers. You talk about in the book that there are aesthetic values, cultural values, even aspects of philosophical values that are in these discussions. Can you take us through these ideas?
Yes. I agree. In some ways, I think what the filmmakers say about the optical printer is even more interesting than what it is. If you're unfamiliar with it, I should probably just say as quickly as I can that an optical printer is a re-photography device where you can, there's a camera and there's a projector and you put your exposed footage into the sort of projector side. And then in the camera side, as you're refilming frame by frame, you can change your original image in all kinds of ways. You can slow it down, you can speed it up, you can reverse the orientation or change the size of objects. You can do maps where you combine images across, you know, multiple passes. You can do visual mashups. So this is how Hollywood filmmakers essentially did many of their special effects from, you know, the 1930s all the way through the 1990s, kind of the pre-digital turn. But the filmmakers that I'm talking about aren't really the professional printers that they used to make Star Wars on, those were way out of the range of most experimental filmmakers. These were kind of lower budgeted, more DIY printers that sprang up out of experimental film culture. So the filmmakers themselves could use them. Often they would, you know, if you did a lot of optical printing, you would own your own JK optical printer, which was sort of the low budget mass manufactured one. Or you could get access to one in art school or filmmaking school. Anyway, that's what the technology itself is. But then as I kind of dug into this, I was fascinated by how the act of working with an optical printer encouraged filmmakers to adopt particular orientations to their own images, that even the physical characteristics of these homemade kind of machines then encouraged filmmakers to conceive of their images, as you say, almost philosophically in new ways. So one example is to think of yourself, the filmmaker, as excavating latent meaning from found footage. There's an example in the book of the film Daughter Right by Michelle Citron, where it's kind of a famous feminist film where she goes through old home movies of herself growing up and interacting with her mother, one frame at a time. She slows them down. She bores into the image. She kind of, she tries to almost obsess or bury herself in these home movies. And as she's been very open about in interviews and later, and she wrote a whole book about it, actually, she was searching for something, which is the fact that, you know, tragically, sadly, she was sexually abused as a child by her maternal grandfather, and she had repressed that memory, but she had this feeling or this intuition that something was amiss in this kind of picture perfect home movie footage of her childhood, and that if she just went through it and really bore into the image on the optical printer, she could kind of unearth that meaning, which actually, in fact, as I talk about in the book, she did. Another kind of quick example is the act of working with the printer, which normally could be thought of as separation, because if you talk to filmmakers who do a lot of this, they're like, it's not fun. Like, you're sort of, there's a million adjustments that need to be made before you take a single frame, and there are all these tests you have to run, and it's this kind of separation, and you click off one frame and then you find the other one. Like, it's often a kind of laborious process. But for somebody like Barbara Hammer, the pioneering queer filmmaker who really based an entire aesthetic program around the idea of touch and phenomenology as itself a kind of political act, she was able to, in films like Sink Touch or Pond and Waterfall, she was able to use the optical printer in a very tactile way, that she was kind of investing her physical person in this technology. And then that was something that translated to the images themselves. And so with the optical printer, I was really, I think, able to hone in on the idea that technology was not just a tool for performing, you know, a textual operation or an aesthetic operation, but it could be a way of staking a claim as to who you were as an artist and what your commitments were.
And in fact, that relates to kind of a broader argument that you're making in the book, that all of these technologies, not just the printer, are part of this kind of key process of literally how these are made, but also sort of conceptually what the role of technology is in it. You in fact say that we might even want to consider these technologies to be, quote, midwives for the existence and development of avant-garde films. Can we maybe zoom out from the individual ones and start to think about that bigger picture?
Sure. I got that phrase, midwives for existence, from the filmmaker Carolee Schneeman, who's talking about the camera in this case and how she's using it. But the reason that she uses this phrase, which I thought was really apt for my project, is that she's saying that the camera isn't just a machine or a recording device or a kind of instrumentalized object with the job to, you know, solely capture her images or her vision, but that the presence of the camera in the situation itself creates the conditions for an artwork to be made. It creates a situation in which the artist and then whatever forces of creativity are at play, whatever we want to call them, can make, as she says, their entrances and exits. And the thing that's being birthed isn't just a film or an artwork, but something that links up to your entire being. So I thought that this was a great phrase or idea for the approach to technologies that I'm writing about in the book, because I was really trying to get at the idea that these machines are connected up with things that are very human and very expressive and very coextensive with the artistic process and with a life lived as an artist.
Very interesting to think about how all this comes together, given sort of where we started this conversation, the deep dives into the various technologies, and then to think about how they go together again. I would love to ask, obviously, throughout our discussion, I've sort of mentioned places where I was surprised or I hadn't heard of something or I learned something from this. Can I sort of turn that question around? What's something you came across in the research or writing of this that surprised you?
There's a story of technology in experimental filmmaking that's very well known to viewers and scholars of this medium and or of this mode of filmmaking, and that's that technology is in some ways the story of the avant-garde because experimental films use it reflexively or in a way that connects to medium specificity, which is to say that they use technology to kind of reveal something or clarify or complicate aspects of cinema's ontology specifically. So I quoted Hollis Frampton, the filmmaker, before. I'll quote him again. He says that every film is ultimately about film. So the idea here is just that it's a common modernist idea, very widespread in the art world in the period that I'm writing about, which is that the kind of modernist artist's job is to expose the materialities or the procedures that bring a cinematic work into being. What is the thing that makes this cinema? Whereas narrative films or Hollywood films that we might go see try to efface their own materiality or the procedures that brought them into being. The idea is that they're really invested in creating a narrative world that you can become absorbed or lost in, and in some ways forget, so to speak, the fact that you're watching a film. Now, whether that really happens when you're viewing or not is another question, but the idea is that technology in experimental film is often used to reveal something about film itself. So one thing that surprised me as I was researching and writing this book, I expected going in that I was going to learn all of this stuff about the technologies themselves, that I was going to understand them better as material objects and as artistic tools. What surprised me is that technology then was leading me to all of these things through the case studies that I chose that connected me to the world or to broader domains, metaphysics or spirituality or sexuality or issues of freedom and control or intimacy and distance, pleasure and displeasure. So suddenly writing about this book about technology in these films became, with each film, it was like I was bringing in all of this other stuff through the films and what the filmmakers were talking about that were like linking up to all of these kind of big capital letter overarching subjects that had a lot to do with not technology itself, but the world outside. And that became a kind of central contention of the book, is that experimental filmmakers aren't just, I mean, some of them are definitely interested in cinematic ontology. There's no question about that. But there are many other ways to use technology that connect to domains that we wouldn't necessarily think of as themselves technological.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that and taking us through it. I personally find it very interesting when people kind of who are the closest to a particular research project sort of go in with some idea of what you might find and they go, hang on a second, right? Oh, okay, that's not the story I was expecting to find. So really interesting to hear that was the case in this instance.
Yeah, but of course, also fun Please. Part of writing a book too. I mean, that's the, mm-hmm. the, you know, if you sort of know it all ahead of time, I mean, that can be very frustrating. Sometimes I wish I knew it all ahead of time and it would be a lot easier to write it, but ultimately then what would the point be, right?
That is a very good point. And of course, now you have written it, the book is out. People can go read the story in all of its detail. Is there anything, therefore, that you might be working on now or next that you'd like to give us a sneak preview of?
Yes, I'm currently working on a biography, which isn't something that I necessarily thought I would be doing as my next project, but that's what presented itself as most pressing. It's a biography of Stan Brakhage. Stan Brakhage is a very famous experimental filmmaker, maybe the most famous apart from Andy Warhol. He had a 50-year career. He made hundreds of films. He wrote several books of film theory and analysis. And everybody who knows about experimental film, and a lot of people who don't know anything about experimental film, know that he's a major figure. But there has been no biography written about him. And so I've been conducting research in his papers, his archival collection at the University of Colorado Boulder and some other archival collections in the US. I've been interviewing his friends and family members and children and people who knew him very well. And the biography is going to try to account for his life and films together. It's a very, very big, ambitious project, but I'm excited about it.
Well, that's the key. And I think that's what usually makes a project successful. So best of luck with that. It does sound, I mean, massive, but also quite interesting.
Thank you.
And of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been talking about, titled Technology and the Making of Experimental Film Culture, published by Oxford University Press. John, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.